So, Steven, great to have you on the show, man.
Oh, thanks so much. Thanks for having me, Luke.
Of course, of course. You've been an amazing client of ours and really looking forward to this interview. I think the audience is going to get an absolute ton of value of just like your entrepreneurial journey and a lot of tips in terms of like the level of business that you're operating at right now. And so I think that the biggest component in terms of people getting a lot of actionable takeaways and a lot of actionable advice from these podcasts and in the Hyke podcast and any podcast in general is being able to have a lot of relatability points to the person that they're listening to. And so I think the biggest relatability points from the entrepreneurs that we interview on the Hyke podcast really come from their upbringing and their initial stories, their starting places. Because usually most people in North America, a lot of people start in a very similar situation. And so it's cool to have that perspective of where people started in terms of showcasing where they're at currently and really showcasing how anything's possible. So, Steven, I'd love for you to talk about kind of like going all the way back to your upbringing. And were there any like pivotal moments in your upbringing that showcase like entrepreneurial and going into entrepreneurship at a future age?
Now I'm glad you asked the question because it's something that's really aggravating, especially when you're, successful in your, 20s and even like early 30s is a lot of people just assume you were born rich or your dad gave you money or something like that. That's like the general assumption. And I'm with you. I found it to be the same case that most entrepreneurs, they come from very humble beginnings. There's a lot of people playing entrepreneur out there with daddy's money, but the real entrepreneurs, a lot of them came from humble beginnings. And I'm no different. I was born to a ballet teacher and a waiter. Didn't have a lot of money growing up. Went to some pretty rough public schools. Lived in some pretty rough neighborhoods. And I think one of the bigger pivotal moments for me was, I had behavior problems coming up in high school. A lot of bad friends. Like I said, went to a rough school. And I was actually planning on dropping out of high school at 14 years old in Louisiana. You could drop out at 14 back then. And I had skipped so much school that my parents were getting like truancy letters from the truancy officer, like threatening to like put them in jail. So my dad was like, "Yeah, dude, you're gonna need to drop out of school." He's like, I'll help you out. Like, I was cutting grass back then. He's like, I'll help you. Get a lawnmower and like a truck, and start a grass cutting company or something like that." So I was all about it. I was like, "Yeah, I'm gonna drop out sophomore year of high school and go be a professional grass cutter." And but then I had an aunt, and she was married to a doctor, and she's an old battle axe, and she was like, "No," she's like, "you need to take the ACT at least." She's like, "You need to like take the ACT and like think about college." She's like, "Do that. And then, if you don't do well on that, then we'll go from there." And that was a pivotal moment because I took the ACT, and then all of a sudden I was like, I scored really high on it. I could get into a lot of schools. And I think that's what she was trying to show me, was like I had more potential, that I was different, I was smart, whatever. So another big thing with that was around the same time, so this is 2003. Where I live, the OxyContin pandemic was becoming a big problem. And like a lot of my friends I grew up with have since died being opium addicts and things. And I kind of had, I want to say I had some foresight to be like, "Okay, I should go to school like as far away from here as I can afford and I can get to." And at the time, I'd been going to high school in Baton Rouge, which is about 100 miles from New Orleans. But back then in the day of the flip phone, 100 miles might as well have been 1,000 miles, so I decided to leave. I didn't know anybody or anything, and I moved back and went to college there and just kind of like started my own thing. And it was really good for kind of getting me out of that scene, and with those people I'd grown up with. So I think that was definitely a pivotal moment when I decided to leave for college, because like we didn't know anybody who did it. Most people didn't even go to college, or they had already dropped out of high school. So it was like a big deal that I was leaving to go to school. And I think that was definitely like a pivotal moment in the early days, just being able to see that potential and see that there was another world and that I could get out of there, So that was a big moment for me.
For sure. What was the mindset of like wanting to get out and actually go to university? Like, did you have a mindset shift? Like, it seemed like the pivotal moment earlier in terms of taking the AST or whatever was an external factor, basically somebody else telling you that you should at least do this, which is really cool. But was it an internal factor in terms of you going to university?
I'd already been working really hard since I was like 12, 13, 14 years old. Like I mainly had to buy, if I wanted something, I had to buy it myself. You know, my parents provided the essentials, you know, but if I wanted to like, you know, eat out at CC's Pizza at the $5 buffet, that was on me. Or if I wanted like nice clothes to wear or something like that. So I was always about having my own money, you know, so that was big. And then two, I think, just having, you know, like when you're working in, you know, minimum wage jobs at that age, you're working with a lot of ex-cons and people like that, you know, like especially like in kitchens and things like that. And I think when I had gotten into college, a lot of those guys were like, you know, they were actually really like motivating, you know, like I remember I had one guy who was framing houses one summer and he was missing all these tips on his fingers, right? From like nail guns and different accidents over the years. And he was like, yeah, every one of these represents a year I should have stayed in college, you know, like, so, yeah, so like guys like that. So I think that helped a lot too, you know, just having like that kind of, I guess like mentorship, even from those guys at that age, you know, a lot of those guys, have reformed their lives, but they've also kind of, you know, like the ex-con thing follows them around forever. They're a felon. It keeps them from getting certain licenses or jobs or whatever. So, they definitely, a lot of those guys definitely were like, this is your chance, Steve, like get out of this life, go do your own thing. So that was very motivating as well.
Hell yeah, dude. And for the entire audience listening to this, I think the component of when parents make their kids have to pay for everything in terms of everything besides the necessities is such a key attribute in terms of what stays with them. Like I had to pay for absolutely everything as well. I had to pay for my phone. And so I didn't get a phone until I had a job in high school. I had to pay for any Yep. bike that I wanted, any single thing that wasn't a necessity I had to pay for. And then as soon as I decided not to go to university and carry forward with the business, then my dad made me pay full rent. Yeah, I was basically paying for half the rent of our house. And then so it just made sense to move out at a certain time. It was like pushing out.
Yeah. Our dads would be friends for sure.
It's yeah, that.
I stayed since I was like 17. I stayed at my parents for 1 month when we moved back from Southeast Asia. And it was just when we were looking for a house and my dad charged me $800 for that 1 month of staying at their house. It was awesome. He dropped it on me too after like 3 weeks.
Dude, it's amazing.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I felt like it was amazing. Like I hated it at the time, obviously. Like I felt it was so annoying. I felt like I was just being unfairly treated when all my friends were just getting everything paid for. And so, but I think it's carried forward in terms of the mentality that I have now. So I think it's super valuable.
I agree.
In terms of fast forwarding, Steven, like, so you go to university, and then what is the first business that you start up outside of university?
The first one was the tour company in Taipei, and then the hostel in Taiwan. But I mean, that was right. I was like 22, 23, you know? So I mean, I was fresh out of college. So,
So like what makes you start up a company fresh out of college? Like what was it in there? Like, was it experience that you had in university? Was it that you wanted more money?
No, honestly. So I had, I was pretty busy in college. You know, I paid my way through college. I think I only took out student loans my last semester of college, you know, cause like Hurricane Katrina had hit, like destroyed everything my junior year. So, kind of ran out of money by the end of senior year. So I was busy, man. Like I never got to like study abroad or like do anything cool like that, you know? So when I graduated college, like I was like looking at corporate jobs and then it was 2008. It was the financial crisis, all that. And I never had an adventure, and I had a cousin who had like taught English in Japan. And she was like, dude, she's like, you can make a bunch of money in Southeast Asia. You can like pay off your student loans. Right now it's like super, you know, this is like when, like, this is like China industrializing, you know, like it was the wild west of Asia, like late 2000s. And so, and then too, like, they're like, oh, you could, you know, she's like, if I was you, I wouldn't go to Japan. She's like, I would go to Taiwan. Cause it's kind of like the best of both worlds. Like you have like old school Chinese culture there, you know, but like, it's like, it's still like somewhat westernized and they pay a bunch of money and it's cheaper than a lot of the like main Chinese cities. And then she's like, you can learn. And then I thought to myself too, I was like, oh, cause at this time I was kind of thinking more about like becoming like a businessman, you know, like after I was done with this like little journey and, but more like on the corporate side of things. Yeah. Cause that's like what you saw on TV. And so I was like, oh, I can go over there and like learn Chinese. Yeah. Cause this is when like all these people are making a bunch of money, like, you know, speaking Mandarin, like doing business in Asia and things. So that was kind of my idea going over there. And then, but then like right away, I'm in Taipei. I'd been there like for a few hours and I didn't really know anything about it, but especially in those days, but in Taiwan, like if you're a Westerner, like everyone stares at you, people want to like take pictures with you. Like you kind of stick out like a sore thumb and I'm on the subway train and this like older couple like walks on the subway train and they're like, hey, they're like, what are you doing here? And they had like these thick Detroit accents, you know, like these Midwestern accents. And I was like, oh, it's like, I just moved here like a few hours ago, you know? And they're like, oh, and these people, they were Taiwanese Americans. So they had moved to America for college, like, you know, 40 years earlier or something. So I was around the same age as they were when they moved to America. So they were all excited, you know, like, oh, this is awesome. This is like the reverse, you know, we moved there and you and your wife are moving here and blah, blah. So, they're like, where are you heading? I was like, oh, I want to go look at like apartments in this little town called like Danshui, which is like north of Taipei. It's one of their top tourist destinations. There's like, it was an old Portuguese, outpost at one time. It was Dutch. There was like an old Dutch fort there. So historic buildings, all that. And it was when Google had just come out with like Google Maps where you could pull up the pictures of like different places and like read about them. You know what I'm talking about? It'd be like a building in this town. You can read about the history. So I just liked all that stuff. So I had read a ton of stuff about the town already and all the buildings. And, so they're like, oh, they're like, well, we'll help you out. Like any place that has like a red sign in the window means there's a for rent, you know, and like, we'll talk to them for you and help you out. So super nice couple. So like we go down there and I'm showing them around and they get a little like weirded out and they're like, how do you know this stuff? I thought you'd never been here. You know? And I was like, yeah, I just like looked at it on Google and like read about the different buildings and stuff. And they thought that was kind of crazy. Cause that was like a newer thing back then, you know? So anyway, like after we're done, you know, they were super nice. They like showed me this like apartment building and like helped me out and stuff. And then the lady was like, you know, she's like, I'm coming back with my woman's group or with our group from Hong Kong. And do you want to like give us like a tour, like a 2-hour walking tour down here like you did for us today? And I was kind of like, you know, like I said, like growing up in New Orleans, you know, like, dude, like the tour guides were always like drunk guys smoking cigarettes, dressed like pirates. Like it wasn't like a very like prestigious thing in my eyes in New Orleans. And it was a little, and I was just kind of like taken back, you know, I was like, I don't know. And then she was like, I'll give you $1,000 and it'll be like 25, 30 of us for 2 hours, which like, this is like 2008, $1,000 and like 2008 Southeast Asia. So you're doing like three or four.
Yeah. Before grand, inflation, you know, like, before the crazy inflation.
Yeah. 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 And with everything being so cheap there. So, I mean, a bunch of money. And I was like, okay, yes. You know, so I end up like doing it for the group, you know, the next month it goes great, you know? And then I told them I could get okra there and they'd been to New Orleans a bunch. So I was like, oh, I'll cook y'all like a seafood gumbo, you know, like after the tour, y'all can come over and eat like her and her husband. And then we get drunk and we're like eating gumbo and stuff. And they're like trying, like literally like selling me on like starting a tour company, you know? And like, they're like, we do this all over the world. Like she's like the wife was like, I can see it in you. Like you'd be great at this. Like you can make. She's like, you can make a bunch of money. And she was talking about this guy in Hong Kong that makes like tons of money with all these tours there. And because I was kind of like, oh, I want to like do business or whatever. And they're like, yeah, it is business. You're like starting a company or whatever. And then anyway, they're going to leave. And the husband's like, you know, he's like, I'll help you out too. You know, like we do a lot of stuff for work here and everything. And he's like, I'm kind of hard to get in touch with, but my assistant will get back to you, you know, if you need anything. And he gives me his card. And I was like, oh, okay, you know. And I was like, whatever, you know, like, oh, big guy, you know. And then I look and it says on his card, it's like Jerry Hugh, CEO, Asia Pacific, DHL, like Deutsche Postal, you know, like the UPS of the world, you know. And I was like, holy shit. You know? So I start Googling the guy. I start Googling the guy. He's got 100,000 employees under him, you know, like just big time dude. And then I found out later, because like they would come back and they always had like a driver and security and everything. And I found out later that that the only reason they were riding the subway that day was because DHL was buying like the like where you can like wrap all the subway trains in Taipei for advertisement, you know, and he wanted to like ride the subway because he had never done it before and like wanted to. So yeah, just like freak thing. And then the group I ended up doing the tour for, I didn't know, but it was the American Club in Hong Kong, which that year was like rated, you know, the like, you know, it's like a British colonial club, like the Cathay family, Cathay Pacific, and like CEO, like HSBC, like all these big time people were members of that club. And then that kind of like opened it up. And then I found that was my niche. I found that I could take like my target market could be Westerners in Hong Kong looking to like vacation in Taiwan for the weekend. It was a 30-minute flight. Another thing at the time too that was big was Hong Kong and Macau were just starting to open up to like mainland Chinese tourists, you know? So all of a sudden, like, I don't know if you've ever been to Macau to gamble, but it's like, if you sit at a blackjack table at Macau, there'll be five people behind you and they're all allowed to play at the same blackjack table at the same time. And they did that just because it's so crowded. And so at the time, mainland Chinese weren't allowed freely to go to Taiwan. And I still don't know how that works. And don't want to get all into that. That's a whole nother can of worms. But anyway, but all these like Australians and Brits and Americans that were bankers in Hong Kong, there were like hundreds of thousands of expats. They were all wanting to go to Taiwan to get away from like the huge crowds at the nightclubs in Taiwan and or in Hong Kong. So I ended up like finding my market, and that's kind of where I got my start. And then, but right away it was like, dude, right away, between the hostel and like the tours, I was like 23. I think that first year I made like 280 grand, you know, like it was like, nice. And I wasn't really working, and I wasn't like working that hard. Cause I was using I was like using a network, you know, where I was like, I was kind of subbing a lot of the work, you know? So like I was on like Hostel World, right? For like the hostel on the East Coast. And then like back then, believe it or not, like Wikipedia was like a big deal. And for like things to do in Taiwan, I could put my tour company on Wikipedia. And like,
just as a contributor writer?
No. Just okay. Back then they would let you freely edit Wikipedia. Okay.
And yeah.
You could freely edit it. And like, I literally just put like my tour company and my hostel and all on the Wikipedia page for all of Taiwan. And it was just blowing up. Like everyone contacted me, and then cause it's in English too, you know? So like, I was just cornering like the Western backpacker / we had a lot of military people too. You know, Okinawa is like a few hundred miles away. So you get all the Marines on float, you know, wanting to come, you know, like hike in the wilderness and go to the beaches and all that. So, it was just like a really good place, like right place, right time. But right away I saw how much money there was in it. And it was kind of shocking, you know? And then honestly, it solved a mystery for me. Cause I used to think it was strange that like, you know, like the two rich kids at school, one of them's dad was like an executive vice president for like Cisco Systems or whatever. And then like, and they were like pretty rich. And then like the crazy rich kid who lived on like an estate and like had all kinds of toys and all this, his parents were like total rednecks and they owned like a refrigeration company, you know? But like, little did I know, they did like every cooler and every Exxon station in the country. You know what I mean? And like, so it used to confuse me because you think like these big corporate guys make all the money. And then nowadays I realize, you know, like half the money is made by small businesses in this country, you know, and like there's big money to be made. So it definitely like took some of the shine off corporate America, and like, it kind of was my first lesson in like, you can make a lot of money not working in the traditional field or whatever, you know?
Dude, there's so many things that we're going to get into with everything that you said, because you just dropped like some bombs about like the Wikipedia side of things. But I feel like this was a reoccurring thing throughout your entire time in business of being resourceful and catching like the trends of things that were going on right at the beginning, like Wikipedia being able to edit it, like when it was like first coming out, a massive search engine basically that it was giving you free
marketing.
That's
what it was.
Yeah. And then later on, then it was Airbnb experiences being one of the first there, which we'll get into, and then Amazon Explorer, whatever. And then we'll get into that. But
yeah.
I think that's a huge component of where like, yeah, you were in the right market. It kind of like was by chance that it happened, but there were so many things where you were extremely resourceful throughout it, which I think is good for the audience to hear. One thing I want you to do, Stephen, is if you could picture yourself in the shoes of like somebody who's in university at this time, where I feel like the entrepreneurial side of things in the business kind of just by chance happened with you. And I'm not sure if you thought it would go that in that direction if that didn't happen when you were traveling over there. And so I kind of want you to give advice to somebody who is very lost in university, because I think that's a huge portion of people that are in university that are just lost. They have no idea what they want to do. They're either going into a major or they're in a certain subject matter and they don't even know why they're in that. Maybe it's their parents told them to do it. Infinite amount of reasons. But if you could put yourself in the shoes of someone like that and they start listening to people that are very successful entrepreneurs, very successful business people, but don't necessarily know where to start, what would your suggestions be for that person to try and find like a passion or something that they could go into?
Yeah. It's really funny, but all the cliches, if you just follow the cliches and you can stick with them, a lot of the cliches like later on in life really hit you. Like it's like, I remember being in college and people, you know, same kind of advice, people be like, just do what you love, you know? And you're like, whatever, dude. You know, like, okay, I'm gonna do what I love. That's going to pay the bills. You know what I mean? And it's like, but it's true. Like I meet other, like I knew a guy who was like a lawyer, you know, and like went to Tulane Law School and that's what his parents told him to do. And he worked really hard and he spent all this money. And then at like 25, him and his wife started like baking pies. They like to bake pies. And now they have like, the last time I checked, at least they had like pies in like the Walmart refrigerator section, you know, like they made millions of dollars off of pies, which he'd have never done as like a attorney in New Orleans, you know, are very, you know, like very, you know, like, I don't, it's kind of, so like, yeah, the like whole follow your passion thing or whatever, right? Like I'm a history major. I loved history. I never thought in a million years I'd be able to like do something with history. And it took a lot of people like pushing me to like make me see the light, even though I fell into it, like I still had to be like pushed a little, you know? And I think my best advice would just be like, don't take things too seriously, you know, like the older I get and the more affluent circles that I roll in, I realize that like a lot of it's just like baloney, you know, just because people like went to better schools than you or they're more educated than you are or whatever, like they might have like a certain set of skills, but that doesn't necessarily make them like capable of being like an entrepreneur. You know what I mean? I have corporate friends that are, you know, they run like M&A departments. Some are, you know, CEOs like Fortune 1000s, you know, like some pretty big corporate friends. And they've literally told me before, like, oh, I could never do what you do. You know, I could never like put my own money on the line. You know, I could never like operate like within like a, like, you know, I need a certain budget to even get up in the morning, you know, like that kind of like, cause it makes it a lot harder when you're doing it yourself and when it's your own money, you know, like that brings in a whole nother deal. So I would say like in college, like even more important than like learning per se, like learning like how to be an accountant or how to be a lawyer, how to be an English teacher or whatever, is learning more about yourself and how to like regulate your own emotions, learning about people, you know, like that. Cause whatever you end up going into, whether you follow your passions or you do just like, cause some people too, it's like, you know, like it's not about their passion. It's about like, dude, I want to work 9 to 5 and I want to be home for Thursday night football. And I don't want to answer emails on the weekends. And if that means I only make 50 grand a year, like I'm fine with that, you know? And if that's what you want to do, like more, you know, more power to you. But I think in whether it's in the corporate world or the business world, like another cliche is like, you know, like, oh, if you're not hearing from your boss, you're doing a good job, you know? And it's like, yeah, dude, like, if everyone that worked for me needed to hear from me every day, I wouldn't get anything done. You know what I mean? And like to me nowadays, like the most valuable employee at this point in my career is somebody that can just do their work and do it well. And like, I don't ever have to talk to them, or I see them like 4 times a year at quarterlies, you know, like that. And as long, so that can be very valuable, or like not causing drama, you know, or like they can solve their own problems. Like if you can just be a problem solver nowadays, that's so difficult for people to do, you know, like I like to define management as like the art of getting things done through people, you know, cause it really is an art form. And the same things that work, whether, you know, a lot of these principles, they can be applied to if you're running a restaurant or if you're running a hedge fund, you know, it's the same type of management principles when it comes to dealing with people. So I think that's something that's going to stand out. Like if you're coming out of college and if you're coming out of college into your career, something that's going to stand out is your work ethic and your ability to get along with others and not aggravate people or bosses. Does that make sense? Like I just hired a kid. He's 22. He's probably the highest paid 22-year-old in Charleston. I would put money on it. Okay. Like I really would. But like, you know, this kid, like, you know, he went to college at Charleston. He just graduated last year. He went to college at Charleston, studied hospitality, but he worked as like a pedicab driver in Charleston, like worked in hospitality all through college, put himself through college. And I saw this kid, like I saw him getting like harassed by this bachelorette party, you know, before I hired him, and the way that he handled it was like phenomenal, you know? And I was like, okay, that kid's got like the gift, you know? And then I told him, like, I introduced myself and gave him my card, you know, and I told him to call me at 2:47 on Wednesday, and he called me at 2:47. You see what I'm saying? Like weird little stuff like that, you know? And then same deal. I'm like, okay, you're down to work all the time. You know, like I'm here, like I'll teach you stuff and I'll use like other managers to help teach you stuff. But like, I need somebody who's down to work all the time right now, but you're going to be like the highest paid 22-year-old in the city. Like, is that cool? You see what I'm saying? So like that, you know, that kid, you know, this is his first job. I have a couple, him and one other guy where now the other guy runs New York City now and he's like 30 years old, but like I was his first boss out of college too, you know? And I think that's a big thing that's going to stand out is work ethic. If you're just down to work, but get paid for it. You know what I mean? Like I've always been down to pay people, you know, like a lot of money if they're going to put in the work. So I think that's one of the biggest things nowadays, especially with like quiet quitting becoming a thing and people being like, you know, am I going to get paid for this? Like, you're going to get hooked up, you know, like if you put in the hours and work, and then people are like, oh, you know, they're just going to take advantage of me. The boss is just going to take advantage of me. It's like, well, take advantage of him. You know, like if you work that much for a year and you're not getting paid a lot, and then you're at a point where like, it's a big project, you know, and like, it's time for you to get paid, you know, go talk to that boss. Go talk to him and be like, look, man, like you see how much I'm working on, like, you know, I want to buy a house or I want to do this, you know, like you see what I'm saying? And then if they start, then if they shoot you down, then maybe start looking for another job or whatever. But I would think that would be my advice, because it was bad with the millennials, but it's even worse with Gen Z, you know, where people are, I don't want to say worse, but you know, people value their personal time, you know, people want to be on the golf course, or they want to, you know, be home for trivia night Wednesday, you know what I mean? And like I said, I respect that, but there's that hustler culture is becoming less and less people that are down to work that many hours and work like that, you know? So I think that's a huge advantage in today's game, you know, because if you got a big step up, if you're willing to like just get along with people and work hard, that you've got a huge step up. Nobody, I mean, I fired somebody with a, who was, fourth in their class at Northwestern, you know, like one of the best colleges. I've had to fire two people in the last 5 years, and I had to fire somebody who was like literally gave the commencement speech at Northwestern a few years ago, you know? So, and nice. You would think like, oh God, you know, like, that's like, yeah, you see what I'm saying? Like, so it's like, that's another thing too, is like education and all that kind of stuff. What school you went to, all that, like, yeah, maybe it'll get your foot in the door the first year out of college or 2 years out of college. But after that, it's on you. Nobody's going to care where you went or where you came from, you know?
Dude, you spit so much facts there. Like, I think it's so overlooked today in terms of people not understanding that they get paid for the value that they bring into the marketplace, like just flat out. And if you want to get paid more at a particular job, provide more value, become an instrumental part of that business. And if you don't get paid more, then you leaving, if you're an instrumental part of the business, will create a huge shock of the business where they'll be forced to pay you more, or you're leaving and going to provide more value to another company because you have all that experience, all of that knowledge, and a massive case study from what you did at that particular business. And so it's literally just all about providing value in the marketplace and value to the business if you're working for somebody else. One thing I want to get into, Stephen, because I think you could provide a lot of value for this, is you went to university. I feel like you were going in the direction of working for somebody else. And so if you were to draw the distinction between working for somebody else and being an entrepreneur, like, what do you think is the key differentiating factor? Because even though the entrepreneurial journey kind of fell in your lap, so to speak, in terms of that happenstance situation, you wouldn't have been able to do it if like being an entrepreneur wasn't in your blood. Like, the amount of risk that you have to take on as an entrepreneur, the amount of failures that you have to go through, it's just not like a natural thing for the everyday person. And I personally think that you're born with it. And so I kind of wanted to hear you in terms of, if somebody's listening to this podcast, how would they draw the distinction if they're in university of like, is the entrepreneurial path for me? Like, should I look into starting myself a business and taking that risk? Or should I continue on this path of something that I'm passionate about, but where I want to work for somebody else?
Yeah, it's, so my big thing, I think it's a few different things. It's like what is your ability? Like you said, for like stress, you know, like, can you handle stress? And can you handle failure? Like, that, it's interesting you bring that up. Cause like one of my operating managers, in one of the bigger city markets, you know, this guy, he makes a couple hundred grand a year. He's in his 20s, you know. When I first moved him into that position, we were doing like a big expansion, and I always call it irons in the fire, right? So like, I might have 7 deals working at any time, and like 5 of those deals might not go through, but then 2 go through. Awesome. Right. And then sometimes bigger deals go through, sometimes smaller deals go through. Oh God, 2 big deals go through. I'm not going to sleep for a month. You know, like that, you just got to be like ready. Right. And he was having the hardest time with like the deals that didn't go through. And I was just like, what's the big deal? I'm like, so what, you know, like there's other deals in the pipeline. We got this going, and it hit me that I'm so accustomed at this point in the game to just like deals not going through that I don't feel any sense of failure, you know. I'm like, oh, that deal didn't go through because of this. And sometimes that happens that way, and a lot of people just can't handle that, you know. Like, do you know what I mean by that? Like a lot of people,
I totally,
they can't, like,
know what you mean.
Yeah, because they're just so, you know, so like, you've got to be able to like deal with stuff, like, you know. So a lot of it, yeah, you're exactly right, it's like a personality trait, you know. Like, you've got to be able to deal with stress. So I think that's a big one. And then on the flip side though too, like part of it too is like believe, you know, you got to believe in yourself a lot, you know. Because you're not like, yeah, I've got great advisors now and mentors and different people that I reach out to depending on like what kind of advice I need, you know. But you're going to pretty much be on your own as an entrepreneur, you know. And I'm lucky, you know, like I told you, like I owned a company that did stuff for billionaires all the time. And I was like 25 hanging out with billionaires. So like, I got some pretty good business advice, you know, like I had a few like good people to bounce stuff off of, but like, you might not be in an industry where you're going to have access to those kind of mentors, you know? So, so that's kind of a big thing, but you got to take advantage too. Like, something you got to take advantage of is when you're young, you know, when you're say under 30, you know, if you're an entrepreneur under 30, you're going to catch people's eyes, you know, especially when it comes to like a mentoring position, you know, cause a lot of these guys that are in their 50s or 60s that are going to mentor you, that are successful entrepreneurs, they're going to look back and they're going to be like, oh, I remember, you know, it's like nostalgia, you know, like, oh, I remember when I was like 25 and I had my first company, you know, blah, blah. And like, nobody's going to like start mentoring you at 35, you know, like you've got to be like turning into the mentor at 35, 40, you know, people advise you. You know what I mean? So you go from being like mentored to advised, which is very different. So yeah, I think one of the main character traits though is like, you've got to be able to fail, you know, and you got to be cool with it. You can't even think of it as failing. Like, I think of it as irons in the fire, and like, oh, that one didn't go through. I don't even think of the word fail. It freaks me out. I don't like that word, you know? And then that's a big one. And then like, just dude, like, and I mean, I would say on like any given week, like, I deal with like more stuff, like I deal with the average corporate person deals with in a year and a week, you know, when it comes to like drama or like, you know, like I got a cease and desist letter this morning from an attorney because their client thinks they trademarked Pirate Tour. And I'm just like, oh, did they trademark History Tour too or Architecture Tour? I'm like, that's ridiculous. And now, but you know, like I have $1,800 to like pay a lawyer to be like, no, you didn't trademark it. You don't own it. It's this kind of trademark, blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? Like, it's not a big deal, but like if I was 22 years old with $1,500 in the bank and I got, you know, somebody slaps me with a cease and desist, a more established company from like a real lawyer, like I might not have $1,000 to go out. You see what I'm saying? Like it would have been like a much, so things that would have been like a crisis at like 22, 23 are just normal, like, you know, like 15, 20 years into your experience. But it's still like, you know, I woke up with a cease and desist letter this morning. That was with my coffee. You know what I mean? Like, and it's like, you know, whatever, you know, I haven't even sent to my lawyers yet. Cause it wasn't priority today. I had other things to do, you know, I had other irons in the fire that can wait till Monday, you know, like that kind of stuff. So that's a big thing. It's just like dealing with stress, you know, is huge. I think another huge factor, and I heard like a short, like I love like TikToks, like the business shorts and things like that, you know, and I think that's how I found you guys actually, but love that stuff. But what I saw the other day was, I can't remember what guy it was, but it was one of the famous guys that talks about entrepreneurship. And he said, you know what the real number one factor is to your success as an entrepreneur? It's who you choose as your spouse. And that is just like massive, dude. I have seen, so like I was in the EO Accelerator, Entrepreneur Organization, their accelerator program in my early 20s, which is a great program. Like anyone listening, like they have chapters in every city around the world. It's called EO and you get into their accelerator program. I think it's like $5,000, but it's worth every dime. It's kind of like they set you up with a mentor, you know, I did the accelerator program, not in the organization, but the accelerator program was very helpful. And you'll be with like a peer group, right? So it might be like you and 10 other entrepreneurs under the age of 25, right? And out of my group of like 10 guys that I started with, you know, and that, you know, 15 years ago now, three of them got super rich on like 100 million plus, selling light bulbs on Amazon. So you remember back in the day, like the early middlemen of Amazon, right?
Yeah.
So these dudes, so first they just like hooked up a deal. They were all doing their PhDs in like electrical engineering together. One of the dudes was from China. They were all at LSU together. And they just like made a deal with a guy in Shenzhen and who had a LED light factory. And then, and they were, I mean, everyone knows about this kind of stuff now, but like back in the day, like you go on Amazon, you go to China, you buy 1,000 yoga mats, 1,000 keychains, 1,000 whatever. And then you'd blow them up on the Amazon algorithm and get a bunch of reviews and whatever, like started trending. You went back to that factory in China and you just bought like 10 times as much, right? So like they had found their niche with like LED light bulb replacements. And then like 15 years later, they own like six factories in China that make LED light bulbs now, you know, and they had originally just started out as like a middleman. And they all, I mean, like crazy money, you know, like crazy money. So like those three guys balled out, and then I did okay. Another guy started one of those, you know, like the food deliveries, like all the rage right now, you know? So like he was one of the early food meal prep guys, and he had cut a deal. This was back when they still had like Burger King and hospitals, you know? I don't know if you remember that, but like they used to have like a McDonald's in a hospital. Okay. So like, So he was going to all these hospitals being like, hey, why don't you put like my healthy food vending machines and like different things in your hospitals and like get rid of these McDonald's. So he had gotten some huge contracts, and he went from like doing his kitchen to buying like an abandoned Kmart. That's how much space he needed, you know, to like do the meal prep. And then I looked him up recently on LinkedIn. He sold it. Now he's like a consultant, but I don't think he's working a whole lot. You know, like I think he did pretty well for himself. But where I'm getting at is the other like four guys, all like who were actually two of them were like the most promising out of the group. They ended up marrying people who didn't agree with the entrepreneur lifestyle. You know, they wanted their husband home every night, and they wanted help with the kids, and they wanted, there's a huge sacrifice that your spouse will make if you're especially if you're a successful entrepreneur, like they're going to make massive sacrifices, especially in the early years, you know, like, later on you can have like an army of nannies and like yoga pants and diamonds and they're living the dream. But like in the early days, like they might be working and taking care of the kids, 'cause you're out all night and all day. You see what I'm saying? So yeah. that was another huge thing, was I had the right partner who, was like always supporting me, you know, like even there were like a few times, like when I sold the companies in New Orleans and I went to Chicago at first, like I was seriously considering like going back to school to be like a history professor or something. And just like, I had a little bit of money, you know, just kind of like, I was burnt out, like get out, you know, I was 30, I think, 29, 30. And then like my wife was like, dude, whatever. She's like, go start another company. Like she didn't even like entertain the idea. Like she knew me so well. She's like, you're never going to be able to just like live a normal life. You know, like you're always going to have to be doing different stuff. So that's a word to the wise, man, is for real. Like if your spouse, is not down for the lifestyle, you know, and is not down for the risk, it's not going to happen for you, you know? And then even with, like I said, with kids and stuff, man, like I've changed three diapers. I have two kids. I have a 12-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I've changed three diapers. And that's not like by choice. That's because like I was gone all the time. I was working all the time. That's going to be a huge thing, man, is your partner's got to be down. And like I said, the money's not, you know, like, the money's not necessarily going to come right away. You're not going to have like all pairs and mansions, and you know that spouse is going to have to pick up a lot of the slack, possibly in the early days. So that's probably the best advice I can give. Honestly, it's like you got to have the right partner, man. You got to have somebody who's got your back. I've told my wife like three times, like, hey, I might like wipe us out on this deal, like in the earlier days, you know, and she's just like it's the second, she's like, oh no, you got, you know, like I trust you, whatever, you know what you're doing, you know? And I literally was like on a Friday had like 500 in the bank, and on Monday had like 50,000 in the bank, you know, like it was like that close, like putting payroll in the Amex, you know, like in the early days. But she never stressed about it. She was just always like, it's cool, you know, get it done, you know? So yeah, that's my, your partner is going to be a big factor in your success.
Dude, sure. That's amazing. Hey, I totally agree. And you said a lot of really good things. You not only said the partner, but you said stuff about getting a mentor young and early. And I couldn't agree more with that. Like I had my first mentor when I was in high school, when I was 17, and he was 32. And it's exactly what you said, where it's the nostalgia. And then my next mentor was like 39. He might have been 40, but it's, I personally think it's because I'm like this young, energetic kid, like,
just
building a business, and they like see themselves in you, and they're like, damn, like I want to help.
And you can tell you like it.
Yeah.
when you can, like, I can tell you love what you're doing. I can tell you're passionate about it. And I can tell, like, by your staff that, like, you run a cool company, you know. You can tell a lot about how somebody runs their company just by their staff, you know. And yeah, people, you get to the point, man, where you can just see it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure you're getting to that point if you're not already there, where you can just, you can tell within like 10 minutes if somebody's got it or if they don't usually, you know. And like, I try to preach that because it did used to aggravate me when I was younger. When people be like, oh, experience, you know, and I'd be like, whatever, dude, I know what I'm doing, you know. And then you do start to like realize where experience starts to kick in. Like I was telling somebody the other day, I'm like, oh, they totally did that. And he's like, how do you know? And I'm like, because I've seen 17 other people do that in the last 15 years, and they always do X, Y, and Z, and that's how I knew he did it. And then sure enough, they did it. And they're like, oh, that's crazy you knew that. And I'm like, no, it's really not that crazy. I've just seen it. So, you know, like, yeah, you're not guessing anymore, you know, like you kind of, you've just seen it enough times. So yeah, so I think that's super cool.
It's pattern recognition at that point.
Literally, that's all it is pattern recognition, dude.
What I would love to do, Stephen, is I'd love to pick your brain. How many employees do you have right now?
I think with subs, like with all the subs.
Yeah, like all workers.
Nationwide, probably pushing 200 with contractors.
Yeah. Crazy, dude. So like, I want to get into like the actual business, bro. And like, I want to hear some different aspects of things. Like if we go through, like say the hiring side of things as an entrepreneur, like I feel like definitely when I got started with Hikey in the business, we did not put any emphasis on hiring at all. And we did all of the work ourselves. And then there was a certain point where I'm like, oh my God, like this isn't going to scale up just with ourselves. So then we started hiring people on our fulfillment team. And now it's like, oh my God, all we're doing is sales now. And our fulfillment team is taken care of, but now we need a sales team. And so we built a sales team, and then we put a huge emphasis on the quality of people that we were bringing in, because we started bringing in people, but then we realized we weren't bringing in the right people, especially with a 100% remote work environment where like you're not even meeting people face to face. And so what kind of does like your hiring process look like in terms of bringing on 200 people? Are you involved in the entire hiring process?
No, I'm probably only involved in about 10% of it. So yeah, I'm pretty much involved nowadays. I'm only involved with like my top tier management, you know. So out of the whole company, there's four people that are like the main people that I talk to, you know, like from an operations perspective. And then if you tackle on two big vendors, there's probably six people that I mainly talk to on the management level. And then those six people, between all of them are managing like well over 100 people, you know? I still set like the quality standards, you know what I mean? Like it's like you said, like repeat, you know? So it's like, I'm like, okay, if you're putting out ads for employees, for tour guides in New York, right? It's like, okay, like make sure in the advertising it says, great side money for Broadway actors, you know, like people, you see what I'm saying? So you want to feed off those different industries that are already there, you know? So like all of a sudden, like you get like great talent, like also like comedians, you know, we have a lot of people from Second City, like the famous place that like Chris Farley and all those guys came out of in Chicago. Like they come work for us because it's super flexible hours and they make a bunch of money per hour, you know? So it's kind of like things like that, you know, where like I've kind of like set the standard operating procedures for everything. And I'm a big believer too, for most of the jobs, like you need to like do, I don't hire any ops managers that weren't tour guides. You know what I mean? Like every one of my ops managers has to know how to do tours or have done tours for me, you know?
And the ops managers are the people who are looking over your upper level management, who's looking over the hundreds of employees.
Yeah. So like an ops manager in Chicago is over all the tour guides. Well, there's two ops managers in Chicago. So there's one that's over all the tour guides, all the hotel people, all the like chauffeurs, drivers, like that kind of stuff, right? And then there's another one that's over like all the like boat reservations, things like that. You know, so that company's pretty, so that one's like split in half. Does that make sense? So like they're,
yep.
Yeah, they're the ones who manage all the people. Like, I don't know half the people that work for me, you know? And then, but I will like have like I'll throw like a huge Halloween party every year or something like that, you know, and I'll meet a lot of them, you know, but yeah, I unfortunately, I don't know half of the people that work for me, but it's just, it is what it is, you know, but I'm always, anytime I'm down there and there's like new people, I want to meet them and like say hello, you know, but yeah. And it's not like a traditional office environment, you know, like they're showing up at different places at different times to like do tours for people or hotels or whatever. But honestly, so I guess like with your question about like scaling it, so I have a rule. So every single person in the company's email is attached to my email. So I have like 27 email accounts on my phone, right? And no one is allowed to delete any emails. And then if they don't want it deleted, it has to be flagged. So am I making sense here? You know, so like I can see every single person's email from everything in the company, and they're not allowed to delete any emails. And if they don't want, and if they've opened it and they don't want it deleted, they need to flag it. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So that allows me to spend 2 or 3 hours every morning seeing what every single person around the country has going on in the company. And then if I see something that I don't like or whatever, then I can like take notes or screenshot it or whatever and call that manager to see like, hey, what's going on with this? Or you're doing this wrong. Or hey, what's this? This is cool. You see what I'm saying? So like that's a crazy way. And then also like everything's tracked across one software system in real time, you know? So I can see like what tour guides are assigned to what tours on what days, what's happening with this, what's going on with the money, like all the reporting, all the analytics, like everything's tied through the same software system. So that's another thing too, is like it never, you know, right place, right time, you know, like you didn't have tour operator software a decade ago. You know, you didn't have OTAs a decade ago. Like you didn't, we're 100% cashless. You know how much of a nightmare it used to be in New Orleans when we were like 80% cash? We used to have drop safes all over the French Quarter, like not the safest neighborhood. And I would dress up like a borderline homeless person with grocery bags and go collect 30 to 50 G's from like 4 different safes every Monday. You know? Like walking around French Quarter with like literally like a Rouse's grocery bag with like just envelope, and there would be like dozens of envelopes because the managers used to have to check in everybody. But all this is done nowadays on apps, right? But like back in the day, the reservations would have to call the managers right before the tours. The managers would have to write down every single person coming on tour, how much money they owed, and then they'd have to collect all that. They'd have to wrap it up, put it in an envelope, and then drop it in a safe. And then I'd have to take all that and reconcile it every, like just going cashless and like, it's mind-boggling, dude. Like it's literally like the software and technology has the amount of man hours it's replaced just in a decade is mind. It's mind.
Dude, that's where we relieve so much stress.
Yeah. It used to be nuts. Yeah, I mean, they used to like everybody would hit the banks on Monday, like all the different tour. And I wasn't the only one doing this. Like all the tour companies had drop safes at their information centers and everything. And I bet you like on busy weeks in New Orleans on a Monday morning, there's a million in cash on the streets heading downtown to the banks between all the different companies, you know, like, yeah, it was wild, man. It was wild times.
Nuts. So, nuts. Yeah. Dude, what would you say your biggest failure in business has been?
I don't know. Like, honestly, I'm pretty happy with all of it. I need to think. Like, I'm fixing it now. But all right, before COVID, I was getting like pretty comfortable. You know, like financially, I was starting to like get to a position of like probably never having to work again. You know, or like different things, like where I was getting pretty comfortable. So I, before COVID, for about 2 years, I wasn't like expanding as much. I was playing a lot of golf, you know, I was just kind of like enjoying, I'd worked so hard for so long. I was like kind of enjoying my early 30s, you know, and I turned down some like big deals that I could have done. There were some other companies that I could have started. So I didn't care. Like I was making plenty enough money and I wasn't working that much for the first time in a long time. And then COVID hit and we got lucky. We still like did well during COVID, but when it hit, when it looked like just like everything was over, you know, I sat down and I thought about like every dollar I ever could have made that I didn't make, you know, cause I was on the golf course or whatever, you know, like all these opportunities to, and I thought about all the like money I could have had like at that point. So it really kind of like, cause you do start to get comfortable, you know, even though you have those like early hard years, like, you know, you start getting pretty comfortable and then, and it was like a rude awakening, not get comfortable. And then it worked out really well for me because post COVID we've been able to do big expansions and I kind of got like a second shot because you had a lot of people that went out of business, you know, or, so you had a lot of need for different things in different cities. So yeah, the last like 2 years I've been working like 80, 90 hours a week, traveling all over the place, like crazy, just getting things set up again. And, so I think I got a second chance at it, which is awesome, you know, and yeah, now I'm making probably triple what I made before COVID, but I'm working 8 times more, you know? So that was probably could have been, it was my biggest mistake because I could have done it earlier, you know, and I could be a lot farther along right now and not having to work this much. But yeah, I would say that's the biggest thing is like, don't get comfortable because you never know when that gravy train's going to end, you know? And nowadays, like I'm, you know, I still worry about like, oh, World War III, you know, like nobody's going to be going to Chicago if we're at war with Russia, you know what I mean? Like that kind of stuff, you know? So I still worry about things, but yeah, that was it. I started to get comfortable and I probably missed out on millions of dollars, and stuff just by being happy with what I had, you know.
So, dude, yeah. That's crazy. And honestly, it's not talked about enough because they're quite frankly on social media, there just isn't that many people who are extremely successful talking about that component of things. Cause you only can have that problem when you're comfortable in a place of extreme, you have a ton of finances, yeah. and you're able to be comfortable. Yeah. And this is interesting in terms of the way my mind works, I want to pick your brain on it, where I find that I thrive off of a certain level of stress. And there's an aspect of stress, whether it's finances or just like the aspect of wanting to be better and wanting to accomplish great things, where I have a certain level of stress every single day. And I think I'm actually motivated by that certain level of stress. And so, is that similar where you are, where like that period of time where you were getting comfortable, like you just didn't have that much stress because everything was taken care of, where you could think about the rest of your life and you're like, shit, I could stop working and be financially free for the rest of my life?
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think it was the first time where it was the first time that I ever in my life was like, oh wow, I can like take a step back and not starve to death, you know, or like, you know what I mean? It was like it was the first time where I'd like, it was like true financial freedom. I finally like wasn't leveraged, you know, there was no more debt. There's, you know, I was well diversified, blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I think it did. I think it took that stress away. Like I see what you're saying. Yeah. Like it took that stress away where it enabled me to get comfortable. And then COVID hit and I've been stressed out ever since, you know, it's like, yeah, and it's right. I'm back. I'm like, I'm hustling. I'm making more money than ever. I'm working like crazy. So yeah, definitely. You're definitely right. It definitely like relit that fire. So you're exactly right. And you gotta, you got to keep that flame going, that stress flame for sure.
Yeah. I saw this video of this guy who does sales training on social media. And he's like, you want to give your sales team a motivational speech to sell more? Say, if you don't make up a goal, make up any goal of what you think you're going to sell for the next week. Okay. You have that goal of what you think you're going to sell for the next week. Now, if you don't sell that and hit that quota by the end of the week, then every single person in your family gets shot. Like you're gonna work differently with that mentality.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, no, it's true. It's it's weird too, because like I used to have mentors, like when things were rough, you know, they're like, oh, you're gonna look back on this as like the fun days, you know, like, and then it's weird because, yeah, now like I look back on like some of the hardest times. It's like, oh, those were the days, you know, like that, those were the days, you know, it was awesome, man. You know, one of my favorite stories is, have you ever heard about the founder of FedEx, like back in the early days?
No, with, what was
making
the story?
Payroll. Okay. So it's a super cool story. So it was the founder of FedEx, and I believe they had done it as like an MBA project or something like that, like in the early days, you know. And, you know, don't quote me on the exact numbers, but it was something like they needed $700,000 to make payroll in the early days. And obviously it's before they're public, you know, and all that. But they needed like $700,000 to make payroll. They had $500,000. And I believe they called the like GM of the Bellagio and arranged to just have it all in black. And they went, because they're like, it doesn't matter, we're not going to make payroll anyway, so we got to hit. And yeah, and they went and just let the $500,000 ride, and they hit it, and they got $1 million, and they made payroll.
Shut
and
up.
FedEx is still here. Yeah, Google that story, like fact check it, but I'm 99.9% sure. Yeah, I mean, fact check it before you put it on there. But yeah, it's a really cool story. I love stories like that. You know?
Dude, that is so sick. Bro, and what you said.
But when you think about it, that's such a,
No, you go.
it's just stories like that. I mean, but that's like the entrepreneur mindset is like, that's how you think, you know. It's like, oh, we got $500,000. We need $700,000 to make payroll. So we're going to go out of business. And like a lot of people be like, oh, I'm going to take that $500,000, just go buy a house and like go be an accountant, you know, where like an entrepreneur be like, oh, like that. Yeah, we're going to let that ride, you know, like we're going to let that, you know what I mean? Like that, like, because that's how I would think. I would never think about like using that last bit of money. If I had a tiger by the tail, you know, I'd let it ride, man. You know? So I think that's a big difference too. It's just people. I mean, you look at these guys, look at like Elon Musk, man. How many times has that guy put his entire fortune on the line? Howard Hughes, another guy, like inherited wealth too. And like how many times did he put his fortune on the line where he lost like literally everything, you know? And I think that's really like the spirit you have to have, you know, if you're going to be able to do this. Are you have to, like, you're talking about, like, it's almost got to be like thrilling, you know, like you don't want to practice like self-destructive behavior, but like you almost have to get like a thrill, you know, a thrill out of taking risk, you know. You got to have the stomach for it, for sure.
It's so true. Dude, like, you're obviously at a level right now where like you're doing extremely well, and you were doing extremely well before, and then fire got laid under your ass with COVID. Like, would you consider yourself successful right now? Like, did you consider yourself successful back when you were like playing golf and like comfortable? Like, how do you define success?
Yeah, it's, I guess it's, I don't, yeah, I, it was fun. Okay. So when I was chilling and playing golf, I was like, I was still young, you know, I'm like 33, 34, maybe, you know? And then like when you're hanging at the country club that has a $80,000, you know, initiation fee on a Tuesday with all the old guys, and you're like 33, like you piqued some interest, you know? Like I think at that club in Chicago, I think I was the youngest like full member whose like dad hadn't paid for it. You know what I mean? And, so I kind of enjoyed that, you know, because it was fun getting to just like hang out with, you know, like, all, I mean, these guys all had Ferraris and all that, but, you know, they were older too, you know. So that was kind of, I was enjoying that. And honestly, like looking back on it, like a lot of that was like a learning experience too, though, you know, like there was a Fortune 100 CEO there that I would play poker with, you know, and like, you're sitting at like the final poker table and there's like a hedge fund manager, a Fortune 100 CEO, and a brain surgeon. Like, you're going to learn something. You know what I mean? Like, so I think looking back on it, it's like I was still like learning, you know, learning a lot and getting like exposure to those kinds of people. And like, I never like made any money off any of them or anything like that. You know, like it, so it wasn't really like a networking thing per se, but it was more of like an exposure thing. So I do think that I was enjoying it then. And then I still like, you know, like I still lived in a mansion, like a few houses down from like Jenny McCarthy on, you know what I mean? Like I was balling, you know, but yeah, I'm a little next level now, you know, like I pay. Yeah. Like it's just funny sometimes, dude, like you look at stuff, like you try to put stuff in perspective, right? So like, I was like, I paid more money in taxes this year than like the average orthopedic surgeon makes. And you think about like what goes into being like an orthopedic, and you're like growing up, you're like, oh, a surgeon, like they're rich, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, so it does start to like put it in perspective a little bit, you know? But then I think too, when you hit that level of like making that kind of money, to be around other people who make that kind of money and see like how they manage themselves, you know, or like how they spend their money, you know, like that, I think that can be healthy too, you know, cause you don't want to, you don't like, I don't know. It's weird, man. You know, you hear those stories about people that like, you know, they're working at a minimum wage job and then they hit the lottery and win $10 million and they're broke again in 3 years, you know? And so there is like a certain responsibility that comes with making that kind of money, you know, where it's on you to like keep yourself in check, you know? And like, and I tell somebody like, when I first had like a big year, like a seven figure, like net profit year, I was like 30 when I first had like it came quick. I went from doing like $1.2 million in a year and like in gross sales to like $7 million in gross sales in like a year, you know, like it was really fast. And I remember and it was crazy because it was all in real time and I could see the money like hitting my bank account, you know. And I didn't sleep for like 6 months because of like the shock of like I'm rich, like not, you know, like by that at that time, you know, the shock of being like I'm a millionaire now. Do you know what I mean? Like I'm a legit millionaire. Like that was shocking. And I didn't sleep and it was just like kind of like keeping it in check, you know, and like and just but I did, you know.
But you did sleep for 6 months like yeah. out of fear of losing the money you just made or just of the sheer shock factor?
Like just sheer adrenaline. Yeah, like shock and adrenaline. You know, cuz like I mean, dude, you work so hard for like so many years and like yeah, you provide a good lifestyle, you know, but like you know, like I was in my mid 20s making 300 grand a year, spending every dime of it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like I was thinking about it the other day, I'm like, okay, I make 10 times more money than I did like 10 years ago. And the house I live in is only twice as expensive. And I'm like, okay, that's not bad. You know, like I'm keeping it cool. You see what I'm saying? Like you start, so you do start putting things like in perspective, you know? So that's what I was telling. So I've got an operating partner in New York now that's about to get his first big profit share, right? And it's been a year and a half. The dude's been working 7 days a week, you know. And then before that, he worked for me in Chicago. The dude's been grinding for 5-6 years, right? And he's going to get a six-figure Q3 bonus check here in about 6 weeks. And I was telling him on the phone today, I'm like, you know what your next, like, yeah, and this dude now, I mean, he makes probably a $250,000 a year or more, you know, like he does well, you know, but like he's about to get that first big check, you know what I'm talking about, like that first big one, you know, and all at one time. And I was like, your next obstacle right now is going to be like keeping your shit together when you get handed a check for $500,000. You know, I'm like that, like, you're going to see, like, can you like keep it together? Like, can you not go crazy? Can you not like go blow coke and buy a Ferrari? You know, like, cause people do it, man. Like a lot of people do it. They can't, they can't handle it. You know what I'm talking about.
Dude, like, the first big money that we made, I was super young, but I went out and bought a Lamborghini Urus all cash right when it came out.
Yeah, see, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah, see, that's exactly it. I'm glad it worked out for you, you know? Like, yeah. Yeah, dude.
Yeah, yeah. Dude, I totally get that. It's managing money. Dude, you bring in so many sick points, bro. Like the aspect of lottery winners, like making a huge bag, not having the responsibility and like the skill sets to manage that money, losing it. Exact same thing when it's a huge fluctuation of money. You even brought your personal experience into it where, like, dude, you said you were blowing all the money that you were making when you were making 300K a year. What were you blowing it on?
Oh, yeah. I was living in a mansion in the French Quarter. Jessica Lange was my next door neighbor. I'm like living next to movie stars, you know. I've got, you know, like I'm driving a new Audi. I'm eating out seven, you know, and I mean, I spend way more than that on myself a year now, but percentage wise, it's like not, you know, it's not the same.
Would you say that pushed you? Would you say that pushed you to making more money, spending so much money? Because, well, one, you didn't have that much money left at the end of the day in terms of like profit when you're spending a lot of it.
Yeah, but I looked at it as like a business thing too. So back in the day, like business to business was way more important, right? Before like the rise of the internet, you know? So we used to do tons of like face-to-face business with like hotels and like concierge and travel agents and all that. So the way I'd looked at it too was like, oh, if I have like a super cool party house in the French Quarter, like that's going to be a place where I can throw a Mardi Gras party. I can throw a red dress run party. So like that was another thing too, is I was leveraging like that house as like a party house for work, you know? And then we would actually like bring tours to it sometimes because it had like really cool courtyards, you know, and like all the New Orleans houses are like hidden behind walls, you know, so you can't see the like decorative courtyards and all that. So we used it a lot for work. So like, so yeah, I thought of it. It definitely in my mind was like an asset in the, it was an asset because I rented it, but it was like in my mind, it was like a work asset. You know what I mean? Like I was like, this awesome party house is going to be really good for like my Riz or whatever you call it nowadays. You know what I mean? Like it's going to be good for me to like bring clients to, you know, like, and then too, like you're young, you know, you're 25. So like sometimes that can be a play too. Like you were young, you know, so like that Lambo at, you know, when you were young might've helped you in your industry because people are like, okay, like there's a lot of 25-year-old kids full of shit, but not ones that pay cash for Lambos or not ones that live next to Jessica Lange and mansions in the French Quarter. You know, so it does add some legitimacy to you at a younger age. So, I think that's kind of something to like factor in as well. You know, it's like sometimes it's not the worst decision in the early years to splurge big, you know? And yeah, like you said, like it does motivate you a little more, you know, you're like, man, I better keep making this money. You know what I mean? So yeah, for sure. Sure.
Yeah, we actually did close like three clients right after getting it and posting our social. It was like an immediate like credibility thing. Yeah. It's kind of
That's what it is. It's a credibility.
Yeah. It's like what we're selling right now with like press at like social media. Like it's all a credibility play with at the end of the day.
Yeah.
In terms of
100%.
Do you still have another like 10 minutes, Steven? I have a few more questions.
Oh yeah, I got as much time as you want.
Cool,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Cool, bro. This has gone on a long time.
I'm enjoying this. Yeah.
Dude, I am too. So I wanted to get on this, but we kind of got off track on like a bunch of different things, but I want to go back to the Airbnb experiences and kind of like showcasing how you had to be like extremely adaptable and going to all of the new things that were coming out. So you were like the first Airbnb experience in Chicago on the relaunch of it. And so how did that happen?
Yeah.
How did you see that happening? And then how did you get a part of it so early?
Yeah. So what they did was, so I already had like that Gangsters and Ghost tour is the most popular tour in Chicago, like still to this day, you know, that and the Riverboat Architecture tours. So what the Airbnb guy did was he was just Google. He was obviously just Googling like most popular tours in Chicago or whatever, doing his own research. So they reached out to me actually. And we're like, hey, like we're an Airbnb experiences team. Like we're getting ready to like, I was actually going through the old emails the other day when I was talking about all the Airbnb stuff with your people. So yeah, they're like, we're doing the relaunch, you know, in Chicago and New York or where we're doing our relaunch. I'm like, oh, cool. I have like companies in both. And then you got to remember like, especially with all these tech things is like these tech guys, like they know how to do what they know how to do. And you know how to do what they're supposed to be catering to. Do you know what I mean? Like they don't know anything about like, the tour operating side or anything like that. So they reached out to me. They had found my stuff in Chicago. They're like, oh, you seem to be like really popular products in Chicago. We're doing our relaunch. Would you be interested? Blah, blah. So, and then like what we do is like, we'd like provide feedback, right? So like, so for instance, like Airbnb, like it's, you know, they very much take pride in like it looking like a hip community, you know, it's like stay at Stevie's place, you know, that's how they started, you know, it was like this hip thing. So they didn't really want to have like the look of like, you know, they're not like, you know, stay at the Marriott, you know, which is like the same. So it was kind of the deal. I think with Airbnb experiences, what they figured out pretty quick and something we were able to help them figure out was like, hey, like it's so if somebody's like, if somebody's like a chef, right, and they're off on Sunday and Monday nights, and they're gonna do, but they're normally a chef at a nice restaurant, and they want to do a food tour every Sunday night for Airbnb experiences, right? And it's $50 a person to do the tour, and they can do it for up to 15 people. If like two people sign up, that chef's not giving up his Sunday night for $100, you know, he's going on a date or he's doing something else. So they were having huge problems with all these people canceling, you know, where we were like always open, you know, like we don't cancel anything. We have all these set times, like you're going to be able to rely on us. Cause the problem is, especially when you're trying to launch a new platform is if, you know, if Luke goes on Airbnb experiences for the first time and he's like, oh cool, I'm going to try this new Airbnb experiences. He books that chef's tour Sunday and then he gets, and he's in Chicago. He's got his friends with him. They're ready to do this tour. And they get an email from Airbnb an hour before the tour. Hey, Chef Chris isn't doing it. Are you ever going to use that platform again? Probably not. You see, so that's what was freaking them out was people like bailing on them last minute because they're like, oh, our platform's not going to be reliable and nobody's going to use it. So that's when they kind of teamed up with me where I had like multiple different types of experiences already. You know, that were reliable, you know, so they could put those front and center and then they knew it was going to be reliable. But then the next problem that we came across was like, people are like, oh, you know, like it wasn't steep. Like, I don't do the tours, you know, I wish I did. I try to sometimes, you know, but like, I don't do the tours. So like, then people are writing reviews like, oh, this tour was not given by Stevie. This is like a big company and some girl named Jane gave the tour. You know, which like didn't go with like their motto either, right? So then like I'm like brainstorming with Kingsley about that and he's like, well, we're coming at, like he's like, we were talking about this thing called like a co-host, you know? And then that's where like the idea came up to like be able to add co-hosts. So now every single tour guide that does that tour is a Stevie's co-host, you know, and they're able, you see where I'm getting at? So like, so they were able to maintain that, like,
so it doesn't look like a baiting switch.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So like that's the kind of stuff you do, like when you help, you know, like same deal, like when TripAdvisor first bought Viator, you know, and like the TripAdvisor guys and the Viator guys were trying to, like, I remember hanging with the Viator guys in Vegas. They were based out of Vegas. And I remember hanging with them like way back in the day, you know, like way, like when, like, it was kind of funny because like the concierge, because I mean, that whole industry was controlled by like concierge, travel agencies, all that, right? They all got kickbacks on everything. They controlled where all the inventory went. And then when the OTAs, meaning online travel agencies like TripAdvisor and Expedia and Booking.com and all those guys started coming into play, rightfully so, the concierge and travel agents were all real skittish of them. So like we would all show up at these like crazy industry parties, like the Hardwood Suite at the Palms put on by Virtuoso Travel, you know, and usually like I'd be one of the younger people at one of those. And then there'd always be like these groups of like other like young people in the corner that nobody would talk to. And those were like the OTA guys. So like real early in the game, I would go talk to those guys. Cause all those tech guys, they were young, like, you know, they were in like their mid 20s. I'd go talk to them and we'd like brainstorm. Like I remember like one of these guys asked me, I think it was somebody from Viator before TripAdvisor bought Viator. They're like, how do we, you know, get you guys like to do business with us? And this was before API integrations. This was when like you would get emailed the bookings and like it was a nightmare. People didn't want to mess with it, you know? And I was like, well, I'm like, something you could do. I was like, the average commission is like 40% that we're paying to these other guys, these concierges and stuff. So if you just come in and you're like, hey, like, can I sell you for a 10% commission? Everybody's going to be like, yeah, they'll at least they'll give you a shot. You know what I mean? And that was like a big help, you know? And then, so yeah, like it's kind of like that. It's kind of like, you know, you hear these other stories from other like industries, like where they started, you know, and like, you know, you hear these, like these stories from like these engineers who built some of the first oil rigs, you know, nowadays you think of like an oil rig as like a very serious process. And like in the '50s, they're like, oh yeah, we were just playing around with this pipe and we did this, you know, like, blah, blah. So it's kind of like the same concept, you know, like nowadays it's all crazy, you know? Like I remember I was staying at the, at Sundance, Robert Redford's place in Utah, you know, and this software company I did business with was based out of Salt Lake. And so anyway, they like flew me up there to like every January we'd have a meeting and we'd go skiing and all that. So I'm at Sundance at the Robert Redford place where like the Sundance Film Festival started and everything. And they have like, you have your own little cabins or whatever. And they have like the guy in the Acura SUV that like drives you up to your cabin, you know? So like, there's like this college kid like driving me up to my cabin and he's like, oh, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, I work in, you know, like hospitality and tourism or whatever. And he's like, oh yeah. He's like, I'm studying like tour experience, blah, 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 at this university. And like in my head, I'm like, dude, we literally like invented that, like coined that phrase, you know? And I'm like, I remember like having the conversation, like, let's call them experiences, you know? Like I remember like, and now they're like teaching this stuff in like hospitality school and like, there's degrees in like social media marketing for hospitality. It's like, dude, we just learned how to do that, you know, like with a YouTube video or like a guy on Fiverr, you know? So that's kind of interesting to see how that, you know, like how that, you know, and I've learned that. Cause like, you know, even you watch some of these like Wall Street guys tell their stories, you know, and they're like, oh yeah, we were just experimenting with the bond market in 78, you know, and like they're so like nonchalant about it. But in the early days, that's really kind of how it is, you know, and you end up, you know, like one of my favorite quotes is there's no such thing as luck. Luck is when hard work collides with opportunity, you know, and that's kind of true. You know, like you put yourself, like I remember when I started the first walking tour company in New Orleans, like the biggest walking tour company guy in New Orleans, I heard he made like $500,000 a year. And I was just like, God, that's crazy. You know, like, and they were massive. Like they were huge, running like huge numbers. And I met with that guy and he was like in his 60s at the time. And he was kind of a strange guy. Like he had like 3 different girlfriends. He thought he was a vampire, like just really weird, like New Orleans guy, and lived in like this famous haunted house, like all this crazy stuff. So, and he told me, he's like, yeah, he's like, you know, the problem, and it's like 10, 11 years ago, he goes, the problem is, you know, and this is before all the technology stuff, and he's like, the problem is there's too much cash involved. You can't scale because everybody's going to steal from you. So you can't do it in multiple cities, blah, 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 blah. He's like, it's just a nightmare. You got to run these call centers because you used to have like these big call centers and stuff, you know, for taking reservations. And it's crazy. Like everything he said that would stop me from like ever making more money than that, even if I was like the biggest guy in New Orleans, has all been solved by technology in the last decade. And it's exactly what's allowed me to scale into so many different cities, you know? So that's what it was. I was just in the right industry that didn't, it, you know, when I started my industry, I thought the best that I could ever do in a million years would be to be that guy and make $400,000 or $500,000 a year. And that would be at the pinnacle of my career in my 60s, you know? And,
now you're crushing that.
yeah. That's what I'm saying. But I never thought that going in, you know what I mean? So like, it's the same old story. You hear it over and over again. It really is. It's when like, you don't give up and you work hard, and then all of a sudden something crazy changes in the market, you know, that allows you to capitalize.
Dude, so sick, man. So sick. Well, bro, this has been a great conversation. I want to finish it off with a couple of things. So one is, in terms of where you're at right now, like, I feel like you're in grind mode right now. Another like grinding season of like 80, 90 hour weeks. Like that's a lot of time. Two full-time jobs fit into one week. And so where do you kind of see the trajectory going? Like, do you have any goals for the next like 5 years? Where do you see yourself then?
Yeah, I want to keep expanding. Like, I think we have a really good model. So I want to expand luxury tourism into the Bahamas and, or not the Bahamas, the Caribbean. So kind of all over the Caribbean, do some of the higher end luxury stuff. And then I want to start another big like tour operator deal in London. And we've got some pretty big vendors. We've got one huge vendor from New York City that is massive in London as well. And then we have some other OTA vendors that are real big in Europe. So, London is kind of like my next big city I want to conquer. And then we're looking at other spots in Europe. So I really want to move. I want to move into Europe. I want to move into the European markets. I think that they could do with an American, you know, little American competition over there. So yeah, that's the big plans the next 5 years, is to get as big in Europe as we are in North America.
That's sick. That's sick. And the Caribbean too. Are you coming out to Puerto Rico?
Yeah. Yeah. No, is that where you are?
Yeah.
You're in Puerto Rico. Oh yeah. You know about that tax stuff too. Then Puerto Rico is better than the BVIs for that. Yeah. Puerto Rico is even, you can renounce your citizenship if you're in Puerto Rico. That's awesome. No, I know what you mean. I went to stayed at the Ritz Dorado Beach for like a month last summer. It was awesome, man.
Beautiful. I love Puerto Rico. Dude, you paid a bank. Yeah, you paid like 30 grand to do that then.
It was crazy. Yeah, that's literally, it was like 30 G's. We spent the whole month there. It was awesome, dude. Yeah, the country club there and like everything else. But no, what's crazy though is you just get everybody at the company is on my Amex. So I just use the points. We usually have like 100 grand in travel points at the end of the year that we use. And then you get so it's kind of fun. Yeah, you just use, it's all free. So we travel a lot, which is super cool. The last thing. Oh, the other thing I didn't mention in Caribbean. So I do like those glamping cabins, and like we do some really cool like outdoor stuff. So I want to do like the equivalent of like my glamping cabins, but like, you know, a tropical version, and do some like surf hostel, like glamping type ecotourism places, like in the BVIs or maybe in like Costa Rica, those kind of places. So that is like one of my other plans for the Caribbean is, I really like creating like, my places on Airbnb and stuff. It's so cool to like read the reviews, and especially when you build them from the ground up and people start like mentioning like the different attention, the detail, you know what I mean? They'll be like, oh, I loved how they did this with this wood, you know, or whatever. And it's like, dude, that's what we were thinking about when we did it. That's cool, you know? So it's really fun to reading reviews is a lot of fun, like on, especially on stuff that you like create, you know? That's another big thing in the Caribbean. I want to do more of these like glamping hostel kind of things on the beach. So it'd be fun, man.
So dope. Dude, is there a place where anybody listening all the way to this like can check out the experiences that you have like all in one place? Like, can they go to your profile on Airbnb experiences?
Yeah. So on Airbnb experiences, you can check out. I mean, I'm Stevie on Airbnb. I've got like, I think over 2,000 reviews on Airbnb. I got a lot of reviews on Airbnb. That's why I hired you guys to do that one empire, like conglomerate website, you know, they can see it all. So yeah, you can see all the Airbnbs from my profile on Airbnb. So if you just went to like Airbnb experiences, Chicago, first one that'll pop up is Gangsters and Ghosts, and then Stevie, and then you can click on Stevie and it'll show all my properties and everything else that's on there.
So dope. We'll add the links into the description too in terms of socials, and then the website will probably be done by the time this gets posted, so we'll put the website in as well with it'll be sick. It'll be like,
yeah, that's what I was saying, because that website will have like every different company under it and like everything. So that's what, yeah, that was the idea behind that.
Yeah, it'll be cool. And we'll link to the Airbnb experiences on the website too. So that'll be in the description. And Steven, dude, awesome having you on the show, man. Like,
yeah, you too, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to get together in the Caribbean soon, man.
For That'd sure.
Be cool. What? Puerto Rico is not far from Tortola at all, is it?
No, not at all.
It's like a 45-minute flight from Tortola.
I don't know if there's direct flights. Puerto Rico has some weird stuff where sometimes it's not direct flights to places that are super close.
I'm flying Chicago to San Juan to Tortola. So there's definitely a flight San Juan to Tortola.
So sick. Well, yeah, dude, man. Let me wrap
this
up.
I'll just come pick you up in my bed. Yeah.
Let me wrap this up and stop the recording real quick. So, guys, this is the High Key Podcast. Cool. We had Steven Garcia on the show today, and, you know, absolutely amazing conversation. If you listen to this whole thing, you definitely got a ton of value in terms of clarity of maybe going into entrepreneurship. If not, then just providing a ton of value in the marketplace and to whoever you're working for. And so, yeah. Would love for you to leave a comment, follow on whatever channel you're listening on, and peace.
Thanks, Luke.